As heaters go on up and down the country on one of the coldest days of the year, there are calls for the creation of a Ministry of Energy from the largest electricity distribution company. The power and gas distributor Vector is warning against what it calls, quote, disorderly decarbonisation, unquote. Massively expanding power generated from solar and wind, without investing in digital technology to manage peak time demand. For example, for people charging their electric vehicles. It says the sector needs the dedicated leadership and resources of a ministry driving the change, rather than a number of regulators and government agencies. Yesterday we spoke with the chair of the National Power Grid Operator, Transpower, one of the country's most experienced figures in the electricity industry, about the need for massive investment in the country's lines network as our electricity supply increases and as its sources diversify. Also, the outgoing chief executive of the power generator and retailer Genesis, Mark England, who spoke of the need for the country to develop an energy strategy. Well, with us today is Vector's chief executive, Simon McKenzie, who's going one step further. Kia ora, Simon, welcome.
Kia ora. How are you, Catherine?
Good, thanks. Can you first characterise the change ahead? We talked yesterday with the electrification of the transport fleet as envisaged and other changes as well. We talked about the need to increase supply somewhere between 60 and 100% over the next 30 years. We talked to Transpower about what that would mean for the central, the national grid needing to upgrade. And we also spoke about diversifying sources of electricity as we become increasingly renewable with more solar and wind. Talk about your part of the puzzle and what you see happening.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think first and foremost, agree with a number of parts of the conversation yesterday that Keith and Mark had. I think our biggest difference in perspective is that was still very much orientated around what we call the supply side. So building more generation and transmission. And for us, it's very much more around a lot of the new solutions and technologies have to start at the customer end and the thinking about what customers are going to need and how they're actually going to use that. And if we think of classic economics, there's always supply and demand. And to date, the system's very much built on supply side, as opposed to thinking about what's happening on the demand side, that being customers. And to that point, the thing that drives costs most in the energy system are peaks. So that's when people, for example, get up in the morning and turn all the power on or come home at night and cook and plug in their electric vehicle. And if you can reduce that peak, then that means you don't have to build as much generation, you don't have to build as much transmission, and you don't have to build as much distribution. So for us, it's very much the thinking mindset has to change much more to a customer. What's happening with customers? How do we actually manage that demand side in a much more efficient way than just building more generation to meet what we would call an uncontrolled demand side? And that can be done with new technology nowadays.
I want to get right into that with you. But first, on the supply side, we should note, barely touched on in yesterday's conversation, but alluded to, a big issue with supply in New Zealand is the dry years, and they may be coming more frequent. And the issue is what backup you have. And currently that backup is Huntly and the burning of coal. Many listeners emailed in about that yesterday. But the reality is, in those dry years, that is the backup we have now. And when that runs out in 10 years' time, that plant reaches its life perhaps in 10 years' time, the question is then what do we do about that backup supply? Hence the discussion about a Lake Onslow pumped hydro situation. From your perspective, what's the issue with the peaks being caused by supply issues? I mean, do you acknowledge that as a real thing before we talk about demand?
I think probably there's two different points here. If we're talking about prices and peaks being caused by increased demand, i.e. when it's a cold day, for example, now, and that means there's more energy required, then prices typically go up because of that demand being high and therefore more generation needed to be brought on the system. That's kind of fundamentally different to how you manage what we would call longer term supply side challenges, such as you mentioned with regards to a long dry period, which meant the hydro lakes were low. And that's more around how does the system have enough energy available to it through these challenging times to be able to provide energy to customers. And so not
right,
only
so what
can
you're
you have,
focusing on yeah. is the peaks that exist when there is sufficient supply. On the supply side, it's about making sure there's enough being offered to the system, right, from generators. But your point is we could be doing all of that better now by managing demand better or by new technologies?
That's right, Catherine. And it's not only now, but also very much more into the future. And that's because I think a lot of the system has been built on, I think as Keith mentioned, very much a flow of energy from generation, transmission, distribution to a customer. And now we're seeing a lot more of those devices at a customer's premise, whether it's solar or batteries or so forth. And then the demand going up at those customers. It's a bit like having a motorway and saying, well, if everyone travels at the same time every day, you're going to add more lanes to it. But if you could smooth out that time of travel, then you don't need to build more infrastructure. And so, that's what we're talking about.
Simon, how do you deal with the criticism, and I've heard plenty of it from listeners, that actually the capacity for providers to do that now is being underutilised, that the smart meters we have are actually have been made dumb because they're not being utilised to the extent they could be to help individuals manage their power?
Okay, I probably agree to a degree that what needs to be a lot more focus on is what we say the customer and the demand side, and then thinking about basically through sophisticated digital platforms, how you can connect to those loads and schedule, for example, things such as when EVs get charged so they don't all happen at the same time. That's certainly something that Vector's done. We have a global alliance with Amazon Web Services. We were building digital platforms in a co-development way, and also with Google X to build what's called a grid virtualization platform. I mean, there has been the use of these demand side kind of loads, for want of a better word, such as how we can utilize hot water. The issue with the hot water loads is that they're on a very old system that can't really pinpoint and focus on where best to actually control the hot water. It's much more of a, you know, all-in type of system. So I think for us, it's very much more, probably more about the future, saying we need to actually ensure that this pathway includes a lot of thinking about this demand side. Otherwise, the cost will be very, very expensive.
Well, let's get to what you're calling for. It's pretty unusual for a private company in the electricity sector to be asking for more central government intervention. And tell me about the concept of the Ministry of Energy and what you would envisage it doing during this transition.
Yeah, look, I think it'd be fair to say we're not calling for more intervention. I think we're talking about how, when we think of this transition, it's really can be thought of like a very large-scale project. As we see, for example, transport move much more towards electricity for, you know, for its fuel source, the criticality of electricity is obviously going to go up exponentially. And so what we're saying is at the moment, there are a number of regulators and government departments that are working on different component parts of this. What we're saying is a Ministry of Energy would be a much more efficient way to coordinate this very large project, for want of a better word. And we see that in the likes of the UK, where there's an office for EV vehicles, which really has been developed 10 years ago to actually think about what is required to enable EVs to be integrated into, you know, the economy as well as the energy system. So for us, this is much more around saying, bring the resources together, have that because of the criticality to the economy as a unit that focuses on this rather than it being dispersed as it currently is.
You talk about disorderly decarbonisation, and to be clear, we're already very highly renewable, trying to get from, what is it, 90 to 95, and but part of that process is going to be an increase in more diverse sources, solar, wind, etc., and perhaps from some smaller players rather than just the big four gen retailers we've been used to. So what would a disorderly decarbonisation, to use your word, look like? What is it that you fear?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think what we do fear is probably a few key themes. One is that, for example, generation gets built in the wrong areas, which then causes expensive transmission upgrades. So if we look into other markets, they're now basically defining zones where it's much more desirable to put generation rather than it being located thousands of kilometres away from where the energy is required, because it's a bit like saying if you put a whole lot of you're developing a whole lot of products in the bottom of the South Island, you have to transport them all up to the North Island or further north. We know, for example, that there's about 2,000 gigawatt hours of solar capacity in Northland, and yet it can't get out of Northland because of transmission constraints, but that would be a much more viable and cheaper alternative. So it's location, 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 I think, is a very critical part, and the system has to move from looking at the costs in the individual silos to what we would call a whole of system cost. So the cost to the end consumer, how is that going to be delivered to the least amount? The other side of the equation is when we think about the distribution customer side, as we talked earlier, is around how this interaction with customers can be made to work much more efficiently, so we don't end up with these everyone turning or plugging in their devices at the same time for things such as electric vehicles and being able to schedule those so the customers are still charged when they need them in the morning. But that again lowers that peak, and the peaks are give rise to investment and costs. So how do we have that orderly transition? It's around location, plus also ensuring that the digital technologies and the platforms that can interface with customers' needs, and basically it's electricity is a product that people only care about when they don't have it. You don't want to make that complex. It's pretty much set and forget, but it's managed behind the scenes in a very sophisticated platforms.
So what Keith Turner was talking about yesterday was the need for somebody, I don't know whether it's currently the Electricity Authority or whether it's currently Transpower, to have eyes over their whole system and see what is happening in real time. And the challenge with that, to some extent, is going to be privacy. He talked about ultimately being able to see what's happening in individual homes, right? So that you can have the kind of coordination and just-in-time supply that you're talking about to smooth things. Would you agree?
I agree in part. I don't agree that it has to be one entity, for example, like Transpower. I mean, I think, as we mentioned earlier, we're already building these platforms and systems to get that visibility, not into what a customer is doing, but understanding what is going on in different parts of our network. If we think about how the system's built, you've got the distribution network, which is essentially covering cities and communities, how that gets coordinated to the delivery points from Transpower. That information at the delivery point can be seen by Transpower now. It's about what platforms they have to be able to say, well, how does the changes going on there? What can we forecast from what's going on there? What do we know about what's going on there? How does that interface with what's happening up in the generation side? So I actually think it's not one system. It's about being able to have multiple systems that can talk to each other at handover points. That's critical.
Keith Turner also talked yesterday about how this is becoming and will increasingly become like a neural system, like a nervous system, rather than having, you know, as we said, four big suppliers of generators, rather one national grid operator primarily, you know, marrying up supply and demand. And then what are you, 29 distributors? We're looking at the prospect of this becoming much more of a two-way grid, and we're looking at the prospect of a much more decentralised system, possibly involving a lot of smaller players and ultimately individual households. And I want to come back to the households at the moment. But is this also what you're talking about? A system that is going to look more like a neural system where one must speak and communicate to the next, to the next, to the next for the system to function?
Yes, absolutely. And you know, definitely agree on that. That's exactly the collaboration that we're working on with Amazon and Google X of building those systems. We have those running you know, probably what we call the beta version, but they're certainly running now, and that's a very different type of mindset and technology to have over the traditional systems. And as you mentioned, it's because multiple flows are now occurring in the networks that never were there before. And we've seen that in markets where there's been a lot of solar penetration, or there's a lot more what's called intermittency with the different types of generation, such as solar, and how did batteries get integrated into the system to make those decisions. So it's very much that need is there, which would go into a what we call a more centralized decision-making system. I think the point being, decentralized is exactly why we're saying this is not a centralized kind of mindset of supply side. It's the decentralized is taking into account much more understanding what's going on at the customer level, because of that interface that we're going to see into the future with the types of solutions that customers will have on their industries or their premises.
So let's get to the nub of the two-way grid, because goodness, every time we do these stories, we hear from listeners as well, who have invested in rooftop solar and who are hugely frustrated by the solar buyback rates. And I'm just looking at the range of them here at the moment. They're ranging, one company's 17 cents plus GST per kilowatt hour, down to 12 cents for another, down to 11 cents, 10 cents for another, 9 cents for another. People just say, look, this is not fair. Why is the electricity we're providing at such a cheaper rate? And second, we recall the Hawke's Bay Lines company that went to court to defend what people dubbed the solar tax, an extra charge on customers who had solar panels. When is this industry going to mature to incorporate and encourage household or small community or small business solar?
Yeah, look, I think there's always going to be in these transitions some, differences and some circumstances, which, you know, I probably wouldn't comment on what happened down in Hawke's Bay. I mean, there's different perspectives on what happens when solar connects to a network and whether or not if that solar energy is being exported. I guess there's a question of equity, is that if people are exporting their electricity and using the network, why should they not pay for the use of the network like others are that are buying energy from the network?
So just pause for me here, because this is what we were talking about yesterday with the business model of the lines companies. Is it fundamentally upset by having more and more customers either exporting or dropping off grid, in which case that's fewer transmission line charges coming in? What is the threat to the business model of the lines companies of a lot of household solar?
Oh, look, I think there's probably a couple of key points. I don't think there's a significant threat. I think it's much more around ensuring that the mindset of the business changes to accommodate these types of solutions coming onto the network. And we've seen that in other markets where there's a lot of solar, it actually becomes an issue about how can you ensure that solar can be actually exported to other parts of the community. And as well as that, you know, there's a lot of lines businesses that are evolving their business models already and have done so quite significantly. We see companies like Top Energy have built geothermal, and that's making prices much lower up in Northland than they would otherwise be by building geothermal plants. We, for example, have done a project with Ngāti Whātua in the Kupe Street development where we've put solar and battery into their affordable homes with them when they were building them to make their homes more affordable. So I think, with most distribution companies have put in electric vehicle charges. I think it's really just about a transition and kind of going back to your point around, you know, the buyback rates. That's fundamentally an issue for the generation retail side. One of the things that we have trialled as an energy distribution company is recognising, well, if people put solar on their roofs, they may want to sell it to their neighbour or give it to their community. And that's a technology called peer-to-peer trading. And that's something that we did trial. But again, that kind of comes back to the Ministry of Energy. We need a central party to coordinate how you can make those new types of solutions available rather than just sticking with the existing market model, which is very much orientated around the supply side. So, you know, there's a range of solutions that can be put in place here to ensure that the customers could trade their own energy, they could get a fair price for it. And in fact, you know, a large industrial customer that could put in a large-scale solar farm, for example, on its rooftop, wanting to be able to send that excess energy down to its office in another part of the network, that would make the economics a lot more viable for them potentially than having to sell it and then buy it back at the retail rate.
Simon, you talked about the peak times, and let's really get to the nub of this now. Electric cars, I want to talk first of all about the capacity into houses at the moment and whether the existing lines into houses from the street are going to cope with some of the demand that's turning up, or that's another big project. And second, can we talk about these peak times where everyone's doing everything at the same time? If the electrification of the fleet picks up speed, more second-hand vehicles become available at more reasonable prices, or the subsidies, or there's whatever else that happens, are we anywhere near ready to manage the demand impact? Or is this what you're warning of? We are going to hit peak after peak after peak in demand because there's no coordination.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a few themes to unpick there, Catherine. Firstly, if we kind of look at projections, 2030 is kind of the point of inflection, which from the Climate Change Commission's modelling kind of starts looking at a very, you know, a more rapid increase in electric vehicles. And I think that's pretty consistent with what we're seeing with vehicle manufacturers really starting now to build more capacity and, you know, tend towards putting out more electric vehicles. So, you know, 7 years in infrastructure is a pretty short period of time. So what we are talking about is we need to have the regulatory settings in place. For example, we know from a technology perspective that we can actually coordinate and connect to customers' electric vehicle chargers and actually, for want of a better word, talk to them and say, okay, we know Catherine is plugged in and we know a next door neighbour is plugged in. We'll just schedule them so that that doesn't all happen at once, but both customers will have their energy ready when they need it in the car in the morning. And so we've done a large-scale trial of that, 200 electric vehicle chargers. Customers noticed no issues with regards to having their vehicles charged, but it significantly lowered the demand. So the technology is available. We know that can be done, but we need the decisions, particularly from the regulatory and policy side, to say, yes, this needs to be done. Because if it's not a requirement, as it is in the UK, then people will go and connect their devices or, you know, electric vehicles in all at the same time. We can't coordinate it, which means the peaks go up on the network. The capacity that's available on the network becomes challenged depending on the concentration of load in particular areas. And it will be, you know, down to street by street is very much the issue, which gives rise to
price,
you know, what you call price challenges, okay, which, again, can't be socialised across everyone.
Now, Simon, final point about the capacity of lines into individual houses. If you've got an electric vehicle or maybe two, and perhaps you've, you've got some other intensive energy use happening in that house as well, are there some houses getting to the point where the physical infrastructure from the street to the house, or indeed the street infrastructure, is going to be tested by our increase in usage?
Obviously, what I'd say is across the country, the design characteristics of networks do vary, but by and large, it does get to a point where that can become a challenge, and that's why these control and, you know, neural systems are needed to understand where these challenges could occur. If someone was putting in significant amounts of charging, say, for example, two large fast chargers at their home, may not occur, but if someone did, that could become, there's always a finite point. What we're saying is from our network capacity, we also have to look at not only the electric vehicles, but the other things going on. So densification of housing, for example, is a very material challenge where we're seeing, you know, quarter acre sections or houses being demolished and then, you know, large-scale apartment blocks put up, which significantly increase the load. So there's many factors that go into how does the existing network have to be able to manage with this going forward? How do we invest most efficiently given the available capacity now? First prioritisation, how do we use that available capacity to best effect? And then what solutions can be done to defer the amount of investment while still providing the service? For example, putting in large-scale batteries like we've done in Glen Innes, the use of digital platforms, and then, you know, the last case scenario is really having to build more capacity into the network.
Simon, thank you. I hope someone's listening about what you're calling for, because, yes, a little bit like talking to Keith yesterday, one sense the longer the lead-in time, the better to avoid or to get the best outcomes. Appreciate your time this morning. That is Simon McKenzie of Vector.